Now, PW Torch brings you the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. It's time to talk this week's WWE SmackDown Live.
Let me click that. If you are listening to us, but you cannot email the show or you can't call the show, then email us instead. So that's a good way to do it. If you're listening, but for some reason can't participate with a phone call, go ahead and email us your question or comment in response to the program. Again, the email wadekellerpodcast@pwtorch.com. If you do call us, please push 1 on your keypad to indicate that you want to be on the program. You can call the show, but if you don't push 1, we won't bring you on the show. So be sure to do that after you call. All right. So let's continue our the show by going to callers, and we will begin with 615. Go ahead, 615. Please state your name and where you're calling from.
What's up, Wade? This is Sean, proud VFP member from Murfreesboro, Tennessee. How you guys doing?
Good to hear from you again, Sean. What's up tonight?
Yeah, I apologize, Wade. I didn't get to hear you guys before, so if I talk about something you already talked about, I apologize for that. Something was weird with my connection. It was, like, weird. No, but the show, I thought the show was actually pretty good. Like, the ending with Roman, I don't know where that's going. That was weird. That kind of threw me off. I was like, well, that's interesting. Kind of different. But I wanted to know what you guys thought about – I know I'd heard that they'd already spoiled with Trish and Charlotte, you know, going to be – having the SummerSlam match, but I really thought the back and forth between them was really good, actually. I mean, it kind of, you know, got me excited about the match, even though I don't know what it's going to be. Obviously, Charlotte's going to win, but, I mean, what did you guys think about that? I know you probably already talked about it, but I really liked that segment. I thought it was really good. I thought both did a pretty good job and got you kind of eager about it.
Jake, I've never thought that Trish is particularly good on the microphone. I don't think that was her strength. During her time as a headline female performer for WWE. I didn't think tonight was an exception either. I don't think she was particularly strong, but I thought she was okay. I thought she was relatable, if not a little stiff in her emotions and facial expressions and execution, which has always been an issue. But I thought she was better than usual for her. And Charlotte was her usual sing-song self who talks like this. And it works to a certain degree with her character, but it feels so cliche-ridden. It almost feels like an animatronic wax figure speaking lines that were pre-programmed by the writers, and with someone hitting a dial button to turn the volume up as she talks. So to me, like when I think of those two in a segment, my expectations are low. I thought it was okay. I thought that, again, I talk about like the presupposition of why is there a wide angle of Kayla Braxton, a wider shot than we've ever seen before for any segment in WWE TV ever. And then scaffolding starts falling over. And we're like, oh, okay, well, that's why they did that. Why is Trish Stratus on SmackDown being interviewed by Jerry Lawler? I get Jerry Lawler, it's Memphis, but why is Trish there? The whole presupposition for the interview is I was at a cottage on vacation and therefore I couldn't be at the Raw reunion, but I felt so bad I decided to show up tonight. That felt kind of flimsy. The interview was going nowhere fast. I'm surprised we didn't get a babyface pop for Charlotte interrupting it because it was sort of meandering purposelessly. So, I mean, I had a bunch of issues with it. It sounds like I disliked it more than I did. I think it was easy. The things that were wrong with it were largely fixable, although you're little contained by Trish and Charlotte's promo skills. So, I don't know. I mean, mixed feelings. I'm okay with the match. I think it adds a little extra, something extra to SummerSlam, although I kind of think Trish Stratus's legacy, status, and popularity tends to be overrated. I just don't think that it's translated all these years later in the way that they frame her. That said, she was the biggest star of that era, and I wouldn't veto the match being a special attraction match at SummerSlam. So those are a bunch of my random thoughts on it. What do you think, Jake?
Yeah, I kind of had some of the same complaints you did about, you know, Charlotte's always had that issue with her kind of upspeak promo tone where she's very monotone and then she just gets really loud at the end of her sentences for some reason. And I don't know if they you know, if she thinks or if the people who are, producing her think that is some kind of substitute for genuine inflection and emotion, but it's kind of a poor man's substitute. I don't think it works particularly well, but it's just kind of become her promo cadence. And I don't know if it worked here. And you mentioned Trish being kind of stiff. And I think a lot of that has to do with her lack of facial expressions. And I don't know how much of that is, you know, I may be misremembering, but I remember her being more animated in the past than she was here. She just played it very straight, and they almost leaned a little bit too heavy into her being like this, you know, this mom, you know, from Canada with her, you know, she even seemed to like lean into her accent a little bit more than she did in the past. I think they're really going hard for the Toronto crowd, you know, in for SummerSlam. So it's like you have Trish, you have Natty doing the, you know, very, you know, Canadian thing with her promotion with Becky. And so they really are leaning hard into getting that crowd hot in that arena on that show. But I don't think it's necessarily working particularly well on television in Memphis. You know, it's just not going to have the same kind of reaction there. So it was a passable segment, but I, you know, they're going to have to do a little bit more work to get me legitimately excited about the match. I think it'll end up being probably pretty good, and they'll have to be careful to make sure it doesn't come across as more high profile than the women's championship matches, because I think with the level of star power, that's always a temptation. But it's, you know, it'll be a nice special attraction for SummerSlam.
You're a little more confident than I am in how good it'll be, but maybe only slightly. You know, I mean, I think there's a wide range of how it could work. And part of that is just Trish keeps herself in shape. But ring timing is a big deal. And Charlotte, you know, had a really bad match Lacey Evans. That's what I'm thinking of. Sorry, Dana. And Becky had a decent match with her. So I'm a little worried, even with all of Trish's experience. I think they might be leaning on some of Trish's, you know, kind of signature well-known moves. But in terms of the timing and the, you know, things looking crisp and everyone being in the right place at the right time, I hope they have time to practice, because I think Charlotte needs to be in there with somebody who's at least as good as her to have a passable match or a good match, I'll put it that way. And Trish was once, you know, right around Charlotte's level as a worker. They each had some different pluses and minuses athletically and ring work wise, but I don't think they're that far off in terms of how they're looked at as workers, but Trish is far removed from it. So I do have some concern in that respect, but you know, the crowd's going to be into Trish, and that's going to help buoy the match and kind of keep people engaged, even if the wrestling gets kind of clunky. Sean, back to you. Any follow-up?
Yeah. And first I want to say, I really pray Charlotte does not do a moonsault, but I know that's going to happen. So let's get ready for that. Let's prepare for it.
Let me ask, why do you hope she doesn't? I might know, but.
Well, I mean, it's just, because like you said, it's horrible. Like, the other thing I don't understand is when she's wrestling, the why do they get so far near the turnbuckle? It's like, there's no way she can perform it regardless if it's good or not, because they're so close to the turnbuckle that it just looks like an awful move going into it, because she can't land it, even if she could. So that's what I always don't like about it.
I think there's a lot. And also, heels shouldn't be doing moonsaults, but, you know. Whatever.
Yeah.
I agree.
The next thing I was going to talk about was, I mean, I love what they're doing with Bray. I mean, I really do enjoy where they're going with it. But what do you guys think about, does it hurt him by going up against a damaged Finn Balor? Because I think that really hurts it. I mean, I know there's probably, I mean, he's going to get a good decisive win, and I think that might help Finn, because they could take him away for a while and, you know, repackage him, bring him as a heel or whatever at some point. But does this damage him by, you know, just whooping a, you know, pretty kind of Finn Balor just isn't going nowhere right now fast.
Jake, what do you think of the decision to put the Fiend against Finn Balor and the hype for it?
I think they've done an admirable job of keeping the promo segments interesting. You know, Finn Balor hasn't been the best promo, in WWE, but he did a passable job last week. And I thought the Funhouse segment did added a little extra layer to intrigue about Bray Wyatt this week, you know, about where they had the rabbit kind of explain that, you know, people really don't understand what the Funhouse is. And so there's a little bit of mystery going forward with that. Did Cesaro damage Aleister Black because, you know, he's the guy that's in 50-50 kind of situations all the time? I don't really think so. So as long as the Fiend gets a decisive victory and they continue to move him into more important feuds, I think he'll be fine. I don't think it's a major concern unless they manage to flub it in some way at SummerSlam.
If Balor's, you know, for sure taking some personal time off after SummerSlam, and you knew that was going to happen, what do we do with a Fiend for a first match? Well, let's put him against Finn Balor. I mean, if I'm fine with the Fiend going over Finn Balor, I don't see him as damaged. I see Balor as a credible wrestler for the Fiend to get a big win over at SummerSlam. And I think the percentage of fans who assume or know or believe that Finn is taking time off and therefore he's for sure going to lose is relatively low. So I don't think it affects things that much. I'm fine with that being a match where the Fiend can get a credible win against an established star who isn't at, you know, the top level right now, but that next level down.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. No, I like that a lot. Just two more quick things. The first one was, love the KO Drew match. I mean, I thought it was really good, but, and so I know it was good for KO to get the win, and I did like that. He got a win he needed going into the match against Shane. Thank God Shane only had the one promo. But at the same time, you know, what do you think about Drew? Like, where does Drew go from here? It's like, it turned out that being the lackey for Shane has really hurt him. It's damaged him in some way. Not totally. Like, he can recover because I think he's so good. But where do you think Drew's going to go from here? Like, where can he go? And then the second thing was, I wanted to say real quick, Wade, is I did love if VIP members. If you aren't a VIP member, you have to go because that Sergeant Slaughter interview was fantastic. It was wonderful.
Well, fortunately, we put the Sarge interview up for everybody, so people can find it over on the Blue Logo Show, the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast. So if you haven't listened to the Sarge interview yet, I give it my highest recommendation. It is a historical march through some fascinating eras of professional wrestling, going all the way through some behind-the-scenes details on last week's Raw reunion. Sarge was great. We got a standing ovation and cheers, and just people were in awe of the interview when it was done. Just some 2 hours of just incredible storytelling from someone who hasn't done that before. You know, he hasn't sat down and talked about those issues that frankly and openly for that long ever. He said he has made himself scarce over the years when it comes to submitting to interviews. And because he was at the Hall of Fame and it was in person, and Bruce and I both had connections to two of the key territories he worked, really three of them. He really opened up, and the crowd was an educated crowd and really receptive to what he was saying and just hanging on his every word. It was a great circumstance, a lot of laughs, and yeah, Sean, I appreciate you bringing it up. It's definitely worth going out of your way to listen to, and yes, if you go VIP, you can access the full interview without ads and plugs and 30 years of archives of our interviews, too, with a lot of great ones. So as for Drew and KO, do you want to elaborate a little bit, Jake, on that?
Yeah, I agree. I think it was a very good match to start the show. I even thought that Drew came across as a star, you know, during their brief promo segment back and forth. So, you know, there's obviously something there with Drew McIntyre. It's just that they've defined him as a goon or a lackey at this point. And if Kevin Owens, is gonna beat Shane at SummerSlam, I think they have to at some point have Drew McIntyre just get fed up with him and be the guy that finally knocks him off of TV for a while. You know, he finally turns the corner and ends up, you know, hitting a Claymore kick or something on Shane. And that's the moment where he finally just kind of disappears for a bit, because it's nice that they can have Kevin Owens do it. But I think Drew at this point is the guy who needs it the most, you know, just to be that guy. I don't know where he goes immediately after a loss like this. I assume he'll just be with Shane whenever he's back on television until SummerSlam. But at some point, you know, he has to be treated like the star that he really, you know, he is visually. Yeah. On the microphone, you know, in the ring. The guy is just polished. And why they continue to have him wallow, you know, in the mid card or as an underling to a person like Shane McMahon is beyond me. I think he should be main eventing at this point.
Jake, this is a more philosophical question, but I was thinking about it when I saw the finish of the match, and, you know, KO is facing Shane, therefore, and you can just say wrestler X is facing a McMahon, therefore wrestler X must win all of his matches before facing the McMahon, especially if wrestler X is going to beat a McMahon. So Drew is going to lose based on the McMahon rules. But if we even just kind of pull back a little bit more broadly and say, does WWE successfully rebuild characters when they decide to heat them up? Is because I wonder sometimes if I overestimate how important it is what happened 3 months ago, or what over worry too much about how a wrestler is being portrayed now based on thinking they deserve to be in a better position 3 months from now. So I think about that with Kevin Owens. How damaged is he by his booking over the past, you know, however many months since his comeback? How damaged is Drew? How defined down is he by losing clean on television to Kevin Owens, when he should just, you know, in my mind, he should be one of the, you know, a protected top five, top six guy who they're saving to be, you know, a lead heel and then a lead babyface at a world title level. But Finn Balor, how hurt was he by doing jobs over and over again before they decided to, you know, push him again? We're going to list all the guys. Like, does WWE on TV and our fans just conditioned to sort of kind of shake the Etch-A-Sketch clean or hit the reset button? And as long as the presentation is compelling in the moment, now the backstory stuff doesn't really matter. And that might not be good, but how important, how bad is it, or is do we sometimes overestimate how important that the road that they've traveled to this moment counts when it comes to just trying to tell a convincing story with the feud that is in the moment?
I think over the short term, we probably over estimate how much damage is done by one loss, you know, but in aggregate over a long period of time, I think it does do permanent damage to somebody like a Dolph Ziggler, for instance, who has been a perennial loser for years. He could, you know, set, you know, everybody's car on fire next week, or, you know, blow up Vince McMahon's office. And a month later, I would just assume all of his heat would have evaporated. You know, like there's a certain kind of, I guess, you know, defining down of someone that just does not wear off. And I think, you know, some of these characters are at a point where it's difficult to come back from. But I, you know, I don't think Drew has been, you know, in that position long enough on television to where he couldn't make a recovery. But I think if you look at it over a period of years, I think you can, you know, put a mark on somebody that is just almost impossible to wash off.
Yeah. 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 And I mean, it probably is case by case, you know, it has to do with a variety of factors. How good is a wrestler and were they being under pushed? Is the angle they're involved in compelling? And is, are their performances strong enough to make people kind of disregard or at least not let it destroy their investment in it. It each is a case-by-case thing, but I do watch this. I'm just like, oh my God, Drew just lost to KO on TV.
I mean, I think performances matter a lot too. You know, yeah. Like if you're somebody like Drew McIntyre and, you know, you don't have the football right now, you're not the running back or the receiver or the quarterback or whatever analogy you want to use. And so, you know, you're just making the best of what's being, you know, what's being called for you over a particular, you know, 6 month period or whatever. And then, you know, they finally do give you the ball. Like, it, you know, maybe he's in line for a major match at the Royal Rumble or Survivor Series or something. When they hand it to you, like, you have to nail it. Otherwise they're, you know, it's going to be right back to the bottom of the pile. And I think there's some characters that have had opportunities that just haven't delivered the performances to capitalize on them, and then they become, you know, your perennial mid-card losers. And unfortunately, there's just too many of them in WWE right now.
Yeah. All right, Sean, any closing words from you?
No, that's all I had. Thank you for taking my call. Go VIP.
Thanks, Sean. Appreciate it. PWTorchVIPinfo.com to get information on going VIP. All right, so we'll go to 479 and then 860 after that. You can give us a call if you want to join the conversation, 347-215-8558, and push 1 on your keypad when you call up to let us know you want to be on the show. You can always stream the shows live after Raw and SmackDown. Next week will be a big show with the final episodes leading into SummerSlam, and then the week after, even bigger with the shows coming out of SummerSlam. And so if you want to listen live after Raw and SmackDown end, just go to WadeKellerPostShow.com and click on the link for the show. Or better yet, go to pwtorch.com, our main website, and in my Raw and SmackDown reports, I have a direct link to the stream of the show. And we're live roughly 5 minutes after the shows go off the air. You can click on that link and go live and listen to the show and participate. You can also find a link directly to the live stream on our Twitter feed, at pwtorch. I usually put it up within 15 minutes of the end of the show or within a couple minutes after, right in that range, at pwtorch on Twitter. All right, so 479, please state your name and where you're calling from.
Hey, this is Grant from Fort Smith, Arkansas.
Grant, good to hear from you. What's on your mind about SmackDown tonight?
First off, Wade, big fan. Love your show. Listen to it all the time. I think I got turned on to it when you were on a Stone Cold podcast about three and a half years ago, and it's been great ever since.
Awesome.
You know, I got turned back into wrestling about that same time when AJ Styles debuted at the Royal Rumble, and then they replayed it like the next night on Raw because it got snowed in. and been really, really following him since then. You know, I hadn't watched from like 2003, 2004 until, I don't know, that was about 3 years ago, 4 years ago. And he just keeps delivering on four-star matches all the time. I mean, that match tonight with Kofi was just phenomenal. And I might just be a mark for him. That might be it. But, you know, with Shawn Michaels coming back and kind of that hint that they gave and that table for three and, you know, the Twitter that went out, do you think we could be seeing an AJ Shawn Michaels WrestleMania moment?
Sure. Yeah, good question. Jake, if Shawn Michaels comes back and only has one match, does it need to be against AJ and not Dolph Ziggler or someone else? And if he has multiple matches back, kind of what's your priority list for him? Or and also, by the way, preface it by saying if you even want to see him come back, because he's got quite a high bar he had set for himself when he was, you know, an actual full-fledged in his prime worker.
Yeah, I don't know that I'd be rushing any kind of match with Shawn Michaels at this point. It's probably the case that he could still deliver. I mean, he doesn't look like he's he's let himself go by any stretch. I mean, he looked in great shape in Saudi Arabia the last time we saw him in the ring. But I mean, philosophically, I don't think he even wanted to do that match. But maybe the paycheck was just too big to walk away from it.
I think you might be onto something, Jake.
And I think he and it doesn't sound like he's enthused about, you know, coming back to have other matches. You know, he's spoken before about how, you know, there are guys that he really enjoys that he would like to come back and have a match with. And I think he and AJ have kind of, you know, had those conversations and teased that they've had those conversations in the past. But I mean, he's always, his reply is, you know, what's the story? So what is the story? You know, what would it be if you wanted to have an AJ and Shawn Michaels match? Or what would it be if you want to have a Dolph Ziggler and Shawn Michaels match, or a Finn Balor and Shawn Michaels? But it always seems like the same story. Like, man, I grew up watching this guy and I modeled my whole career after him, and I just really want to have a match with him. And I don't know if that's a story that wants to, you know, that's going to get Shawn Michaels out of bed in the morning. You know, it's just not that interesting. And so maybe if they have something really compelling and personal that they can get into with some of these guys and Michaels, then it would be worth it. But until then, I mean, I just don't know what that looks like.
So my top list off the top of my head, and you tell me if I'm missing anyone, who just kind of the way they're positioned now, if Michaels came back, was excited, and there's potential for a story that might interest Michaels, I think number one is Daniel Bryan. I think a close two is AJ Styles. A distant fifth is Dolph Ziggler. And I would put Adam Cole and Johnny Gargano in at three and four. Those are kind of the five that come off the top of my head as matches that interest me most. You know, you could say, what about Kofi, or what about Kevin Owens? I mean, there's like, you know, other wrestlers. But yeah, it'd be good, but I don't think the chemistry or the backstory is there. And I think with Bryan and AJ being heels, Michaels can come back as a babyface. Same with Ziggler. And then with Gargano or Cole, you have Cole as, you know, probably closer than Ziggler to being. Ziggler's more, you know, a kind of a two-thirds Billy Gunn, one-third Shawn Michaels type character to me. And Adam Cole is much closer to, you know, prime heel Shawn Michaels. So I like that. And because he's around NXT and he'd be giving a real boost to somebody by having a match with them. And if he did it on a takeover, it'd take some of the stench away from him selling out for Saudi money for somebody who's touted his morals as, you know, basically his identity since retirement. You know, I think he should be ashamed of turning it down and then finally saying yes to it. So, you know, in a way, not that you can cleanse yourself entirely from that stench, but, you know, coming back to give back a little bit without a big payday to somebody who hasn't reached their peak yet of stardom and do it on a smaller show and don't do it for the money, do it for the art, that I would feel better about that too. So those are kind of my top five and some of my thoughts on that. It seems like the Ziggler thing is sort of set up. But the Bryan thing I'm intrigued by, if that's what he means by aiming higher, and they're kind of inching their way towards that. So anyway, those are some of my thoughts, Jake. Any response to any of that?
I mean, I'm not against the idea of a Bryan and HBK match. I think there is history there, and they do have a story that could work, and it may, you know, might even get Shawn Michaels excited enough to come back to have a match. But they – you know, have they really planted any seeds for it at this point? I mean, maybe we're too far ahead of WrestleMania for that. But if they are, I would think it would have to start happening soon.
With Brian, I just think him saying, you know, hesitating to say what his idea is, and saying he's aiming higher. I mean, to me, Brian and Reigns just feels like a yawn. It seems more compelling and might be worth it. It might make up for dragging it out the way that it has been if it turns out that, you know, he wants to call out the greatest because he thinks it'll, you know, add to his legacy, whatever story he can come up with.
Yeah, I'm on board for that. I'd love to see another Lesnar and Bryan match too down the road. So, I mean, you know, maybe aiming that high might work for him too, because, you know, what they're doing with Seth Rollins just doesn't seem to be clicking. But we'll have to see what happens. I like the possibility of another HBK match. I'd never turn one down. He's you know, one of the all-time greats and one of my favorites. But I think the story has to be right. Otherwise, it's just, you know, it's just like that Saudi Arabia match. It's like, what's the point of this?
Yeah, exactly. All right, anything else, Grant?
Well, I guess the second thing I was going to say is, how long is it going to be before I get to see Alexa Bliss and Nikki Cross carry around some tag team titles?
Interesting, yeah. The dynamic and chemistry between them, Jake, is something where I could imagine them eventually being tag champs and Vince, you know, deciding to go with them long-term and not do a breakup. How do you feel about the status of Bliss and Nikki, and specifically Grant's question about the tag titles? I mean, I don't think they'd go right from the Iconics to them.
Yeah, you know, I wish they'd pay more attention to the tag titles in at all. You know, it feels like they've fallen into an abyss since WrestleMania. But I don't dislike the idea of them being a team. I think they have good chemistry together, and I think they, you know, at least their personalities have seemed to gel to the point where, you know, they would be a team that you would look at and say, okay, this is a possibility. You know, they'd have to develop a little bit more chemistry in the ring. They don't really have any like tag team offense or anything of that sort. But I could see them going, you know, one of two roads. Either they're going to have something click in Nikki Cross's head where she finally realizes how she's being manipulated, or she comes to terms with it and just, you know, goes right along with it, which it seems like is the direction they've been going in recent weeks. So we'll see what happens. But I like their chemistry that they've built over this short period of time, and I think they could be one of those teams that challenges the Kabuki Warriors if they end up being the tag champs in short order.
Grant, we appreciate your call.
Thank you.
Yep, you bet. All right, we'll go to 860 next. 860, go ahead and state your name and where you're calling from.
Hey, good evening, guys. This is Jay in Hartford. How are you, Wade?
Doing good. Good to hear from you, Jay. It's been a while, I think, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's been a few weeks.
Yeah. Well, for a regular, you know.
Yes, sir. Indeed.
Yeah, what's going on?
So, about the women's segment tonight with Charlotte and Trish.
I want to know what you think of my performance. Please tell me. The queen wants to know. Yeah, sorry.
I know. I thought the segment was decent. Did you catch that Charlotte apparently doesn't know the difference between being a mom and a child?
I know. That's really a good point. A lot of people here are moms, and everyone else has a mom. So, yeah.
Yeah.
It was weird.
That was horrible. But
how was that scripted? Like, did she mess up the script,
like,
or did she get handed a script and then not think to say, wait a second, this makes no sense?
Yeah, I'm like, that couldn't have been scripted is what I was thinking after she said it, but I don't know. But what I didn't care for about it, and you touched on it a little bit, was just the setup seemed out of nowhere. I actually was okay with Trish coming out just saying, hey, you know, she missed the Raw reunion, but she's a legend. She wants to stop by and say hello, you know, SummerSlam's in Toronto, you know, whatever you could have. But the whole, if you want to have one more match, who would it be against, just completely ruined it all for me, because Charlotte already told us last week or, you know, the week before that she was going to have some grand challenge. So then when the King says, oh, who do you want your one last match to be against? It was like just all downhill for me from there. Like it completely took away any excitement from, you know, whatever the potential announcement that Charlotte was going to make, you know, about this mystery opponent, because you just saw the whole setup at that point. So I thought that was poorly done. But aside from that, I mean, I thought, again, they did okay. I thought Trish was okay on the mic. I'm not super hyped for it yet, and I don't know that they're really going to have the ability to hype it up any more than it is other than, you know, the legend against, you know, the present-day star. You know, like, I feel like Randy Orton and AJ back at WrestleMania, I felt like they completely knocked it out of the park. You know what I mean? But I don't think this match as a kind of a past star against the current, I don't think they have the ability to do that with this one, with Trish and Charlotte. So I just hope we're not disappointed, but I don't know what more they can do to hype it up besides what they did tonight.
Jay brought up that, you know, there wasn't really, and I guess I did too, there wasn't really a reason for Trish to be there. And it's one of my frustrations because, you know, some people might say, well, that doesn't matter. In the end, all that matters is Charlotte and Trish, you know, yapped back and forth and challenge each other, whatever, and they have a match and no one cares about the setup, or it doesn't really matter once you get to the point you're making. And to some degree, you know, if the last third of something is really good, the first third, the setup might not matter that much in terms of its net effect. That said, it's not that hard to clean it up. And I think all of those bits and pieces, all that caring about setting things up, in the end adds up to something that does lead to a better experience. And it's also just, it's sort of like, you know, if you're reading a top newspaper or, you know, a big magazine, an article, and there's a bunch of, and it's like this big investigative piece and it's full of typos. You're like, yeah, I bet they probably didn't put the type of detail into their investigation, you know, that they probably should have, if they, you know, can't, you know, close their brackets and, you know, make sure that they don't misuse, you know, semicolons and whatever, you know, whatever, misspellings. And to me, it's like, they're so sloppy with this stuff. It does, I think, undercut your willingness to really get invested in it. Same thing if you're reading a novel or you're reading some sort of fiction book, and there's some sloppy details early on, you know, some happy coincidences that are totally implausible but were needed to push the plot forward, and you start losing faith in the end of the book, and you might even not finish the book. This is easy to clean up. Trish, so they could have so easily had let off in announcing that Trish had something very important. She wanted to take a stand on something, or she had an announcement to make of something, and have it matter enough where it would seem like it would make sense for her to be there. And then, so you have a reason for the interview taking place. Because the whole time I'm watching it, I'm just thinking, there's no reason this is taking place. Therefore, something is going to come up that's going to be presented as unexpected that will then justify the whole segment taking place in the first place. I want there to be a reason for the segment to take place in the first place. That applies to me, to cameras filming people, you know, when someone's texting on their phone and they film them. That's just stupid, because there's no reason you would do that unless something unexpected was about to happen. And while you're watching the show, you don't want to be reminded by a sledgehammer to the back of your skull that everything is predetermined. You know, you want to have that sense of spontaneity, and they're not good at that. And it's frustrating because it's really easy to fix. So it really just comes down to, they must not think about it as even a factor, because it's so easy to do. If they did think it was even, if they thought of it and across their mind, they would do it, but they don't think about it. And therefore I lose faith in their ability to maximize the stories they tell. So there's my rant. And same thing with the wide camera shot of Roman. You know what? They could have so easily done a normal shot, and Kayla could have looked off to the right, and then the camera would have zoomed over and gone wide, and then it wouldn't have seemed so set up. But they don't think of that. And I think a lot of viewers out there are taken out of the circumstances as they watch them, not even knowing why, but they're sort of thrown off by things. And the Trish thing, again, it was going nowhere. There was no purpose until Charlotte came out. And then you're like, oh, yeah, that's why we're all here.
Yeah, I don't really have any specific disagreements with what you said, other than just to point out, you know, how I think people, you know, we're having this discussion, you know, you and I and Jay, about, you know, how despite all of these flaws, we're still optimistic about this match. Like, imagine talking about any other fictional medium like this. Like, well, the premise didn't really make any sense, and the lines weren't written particularly well, and they weren't delivered particularly well. But, you know, I still liked it. You know, like, I don't think that would happen in any other scripted television show. And so I think it speaks to just the hopeless optimism of wrestling fans in general.
Yeah. Or the resignation, you know, to mediocrity, right. Mediocrity is a compliment. But
and like you said, with the, like, what other television show would have had a camera angle from the position of the person pushing over the crates at the end of the show? Like, it, that doesn't happen anywhere else. It's bizarre how some of these mistakes are made, given, you know, the decades of professional experience some of these WWE production people have. And so we forgive an awful lot, even though I think online fans or, you know, fans of this show probably take a lot of flack for being too negative. But honestly, when you think about it, with all the stuff that we're willing to forgive, we're almost too optimistic at times.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, it's so easy to clean up, and it's maddening that there's people running the show who don't understand the narrative structure, the narrative positioning of how pro wrestling obviously ought to be presented. And I just sometimes I don't quite know how to how to explain to somebody who doesn't just get it automatically, you know, like that what they're doing is not the best way to present wrestling. So anyway, yeah, it's frustrating. All right, appreciate the call, Jay. Any closing words or follow up?
Yeah, real quick, if I could make another point about the show, Randy Orton and Kofi. I thought Randy Orton's video package / interview, they called it an interview, I guess, whatever. But I thought it was very, very well done. I love the continuity, you know, with the you know, throwing back to 2009 or whatever that was with the whole stupid you know, incident that happened there. But as much as I love the continuity, my favorite part was them bringing up, you know, Orton costing or injuring Ali, which they touched on last week. But, you know, when Orton said, you know, without me, there'd be no Kofi Mania, that line just really hit home for me, and it sold the match. And I'm like, okay, I'm ready for this. So I thought they did a really good job. Orton's in this strange, I don't know, world for me where, you know, at one point I was tired of him, like I think a lot of people were, but I guess he's reached that Cena status, so to speak, now, where there's such legacy stars, they're going to get the pop either way. You know, unless he does something dastardly, like, you know, rips Jeff Hardy's ear off or something, he gets cheered. And he had an awesome showing in that Battle Royal a couple weeks back on Raw, which kind of seemed to, you know, foreshadow that he may be getting the shot against Kofi. But I just thought that video package tonight was well done.
Jake, any response?
No, I'm in total agreement. I mean, it's almost unbelievable the dichotomy between some of the bad segments on the show and something like this, where they clearly had, you know, they had a week to prepare it or whatever since they put together the match. It's almost like there's like this team of people inside the company that know exactly what buttons to push to get people excited. And then there's like this other team of, you know, people who just clearly have no idea what's going on at any given moment. And so it's hard to reconcile the two. Like, there's like, oh, this is really well done. And then there's just segments where you're just like, did like anybody even who was involved in this Orton video package have anything to do with writing this Trish Stratus and Charlotte promo? It's like, you need to bring these people over into more stuff.
And this is stuff I would hope Eric Bischoff, if he has any influence, legit say so and influence in this product, can clean up just having a fresh set of eyes. I'm trying to, what do you think, Jake, was, what grade would you give Eric when he was in charge of WCW when it comes to the narrative environment and having a logic to the way that he presented things? I'm not thinking about this being something I complained a lot about during the Nitro era.
Well, I mean, there was, you know, I guess as time wore on, you know, there was some obvious, you know, where the wheels kind of fell off the thing.
But in terms of the narrative structure, that's, I guess, you're saying in terms of that or other things?
No, I mean, you know, it's clear that, you know, that it wasn't just Eric's vision that was being implemented at certain points. You know, he was fighting a lot of different political battles at various times. But I think when he had the most control over the show early on, when Nitro launched in those first couple of years, I think it was a much more logical broadcast than what we've seen from Vince McMahon over the last decade, at the very least.
And when he was in charge of TNA, Eric had a reason for the roving cat. You know, there was a roving cameraman who, and the, you know, they were, they, the, if we saw something happening, He wanted there to be a reason for a camera being present, whether it was an eavesdropping camera or that full-time roving cameraman just looking for a story, approaching people and asking questions. It seems like he's aware of that being an issue. We got a great email yesterday, I thought, that just really put this in perspective. And I want to underline it again today because I just like the way he worded it. This came from Benjamin, and he said he was talking about the triple threat tag matches, and if there's no DQ and no countouts, then why would heels follow the tag rules that still exist? He said, what reason would any of them have to wait around to be tagged in if you can't get DQ'd? It's another logic gap in WWE storytelling that breaks the reality continuity in their own match staging. I'm of the opinion that the single biggest creative issue with WWE Raw and SmackDown is their willful neglect of their own narrative environment. In TV and serialized films, the least successful products are the ones that self-perpetuate and then neglect their own narrative constructs. It pulls viewers out of the storytelling. Once removed, it's hard to get back in. It's also just perceived as being lazy and disrespectful to the audience. The product is still being produced to diffuse through a tragically flawed narrative logic. And I just thought he put words to a lot of my thoughts better than I've put words to my own thoughts in that email. It is lazy, it is disrespectful to the audience, and it is a sign of an unsuccessful product. And they get away with it and have for so long, but it's one of the biggest things I disrespect about Vince McMahon as a content creator is how the complete disregard or unawareness of how important having a narrative context, a narrative construct is. And he just has gotten away with not needing to pay attention to it. But I would just think pride in his product would lead to him being better about that.
Yeah, I certainly hope it gets to that point where, you know, there are people in the company who are, you know, nudging Vince McMahon out of the day-to-day operations where some new regime is able to restore some semblance of order to the way the show is produced, because there's a lot of Vince's bad habits that are very evident on screen all the time. And I think the lack of continuity is the biggest one. It's just clear that he does not care about it. And it's something that other television shows have been canceled over, but somehow, you know, WWE manages to maintain its audience. I mean, you follow any passionate fan base of a dramatic TV series, and when those plot holes start appearing and, you know, the show goes off the rails, there are a lot more people that bail in those situations than ever have in the context of WWE. And I don't know if it's just the exceptional amount of brand loyalty people have, or if there's just a lot more forgiveness when it comes to this particular brand of sports content versus others. But other people have been crucified for less than what Vince has gotten away with.
I just don't understand. Like, yes, in a movie where everyone goes and knows it's scripted, and from beginning to end, you get the best camera angles for everything because the camera's everywhere. It just happens to shoot the best angle from whatever is happening. That's not wrestling. Wrestling is shot from the narrative structure and perspective of a sports crew is there to film a live staged a live fight in a ring in the middle of an arena. And we happen to have some cameras backstage to interview wrestlers before they come out or when they come back from their match. That's the construct. There should not be a camera angle inside a limousine showing someone's head go through it when it was presented as an impromptu fight. There should not be a camera behind crates that are being knocked over. There should not be a wide angle for an interview for the first time in WWE history of the entire backstage area, which then is revealed to have been so that they wouldn't miss any of the, quote, surprise knocking over of the scaffolding. And I don't understand how there's people who work for WWE who suggest this and think it's a good idea. It kind of blows my mind. I mean, I can't imagine being backstage and someone saying, now let's get a camera angle here and let's go to a wide shot to start out. And someone going, wait, how would we know to do that? We're presenting this to the audience as if the cameraman is not an all-knowing narrator. And it drives me nuts. All right, I'll move on. Jay, thank you so much. You got us going.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call, Wade.
Yeah, appreciate it. You bet. All right, we'll go to 516 and round out the callers there. 516, go ahead and state your name and where you're calling from.
Hey, Wade, it's JJ from Ohio. How are you?
Doing good, JJ. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I know the same old, tropes. So-and-so has pinned the Intercontinental Champion. Is there a way we could possibly ever set up a match without that? I mean, Mustafa Ali's great, and that match was pretty good, but, you know, I feel it would be better to do, you know, something like a number one contendership or something. It's just the same old, and then, you know, I feel it's just going to be booking, and then he's going to job to Nakamura at SummerSlam, and it's kind of like, what did we do this for? I mean, don't they have any other ideas besides someone that was pinned the champion?
Apparently not, Jake. I mean, I thought the same thing when that happened. I don't like the 2 minute match, you know, where Nakamura loses in 2 minutes. It's lazy and rushed and contrived, that happened the way that it did. You know, the match was rushed from the beginning, so you knew they weren't going long. You know, whenever they have the at that frenetic of a pace at the beginning. I wasn't a fan of that segment, and I don't think it actually did a lot for Ali, because the whole thing just kind of felt contrived and fluke-like, to beat somebody of Nakamura's stature that quickly.
Mm-hmm. Totally agree.
Hold on. Go ahead, Jake. Yeah.
And you know, I mean, the fact that, you know, didn't even win with his finish or anything, like, he wound up coming off looking like, again, like you said, like a fluke.
Yeah. Go ahead, Jake.
I don't know why. I mean, they have, what, like 300 some wrestlers on the roster. Like, you couldn't find anybody else to wrestle Ali for a number one contenders match. Like, They have a dozen former U.S. champions. They have however many, you know, former challengers. Like, find somebody else for Ali to beat in 3 minutes if that's what you want to do. I don't know why the champion has to be that guy. And it's not just the U.S. championship. You know, they had, you know, AJ Styles, the U.S., you know, losing the main event, they have Andrade losing matches constantly, even though he seems like he's a perennial title challenger. And so I honestly don't quite understand the philosophy. If they just think, well, we don't have anybody credible enough for him to pin to get an Intercontinental Championship match with Nakamura, or if they just, you know, they want to have him on screen and give people the visual cue that, okay, this guy can be the champ. But I think it diminishes the titles, and I think it's part of the reason why the mid-card titles feel so, you know, inconsequential most of the time.
WWE benefits so much from booking their television 6 weeks out and booking backwards, you know, from that 6 week mark, and go to the trouble, and Vince can just hand control over to other writers, but say, all right, in six weeks, what are we going to do with the U.S. title and the IC title and the women's tag titles and the women's championship? Oh, we're going to have Natalya be the number one contender at SummerSlam for Becky. So what do we do to make that seem credible? Well, let's give her a couple wins. It can be on main event. I mean, they could utilize main event, the main event TV show, in a way where Natalya's just out there getting some wins. I mentioned this a couple weeks ago too, and they can just have little moments where they go, as Natalya's coming out for the Fatal Four Way, whatever it was, to become number one contender. And the announcers can say, as each ring entrance is taking place, hey, Natalya's been on a hot streak. She's been winning her matches. And they can show a little clip of her winning on main event impressively 2 weeks in a row. Just little things like that to add credibility. Ali could have been against another opponent who they just had booked in matches where he was looking good. And you have this backstory that took place over 4, 5, 6 weeks leading into that match. It would feel more important. But they don't do that. They don't think it's important. And there's a lot of things they don't think that are important that add up to things that are that take away from the overall product, because collectively it is important to get all those little things right. And I shouldn't even say little things. I mean, to anybody else, they'd be big things. But WWE's, you know, making so much money, they think that they don't have anything to fix. But, I mean, they do. They can make the show a lot better and not have to go to the same, as JJ was saying, the same number one contender scores a non-title upset win that they go to way too often. It's just overdone. Jake, any more on that?
Well, make better use of your house shows too. Like they have camera crews at most of them. You know, maybe you don't have to film an entire match, but if you film a couple of match finishes, you know, Natalya's been on a tear, you know, on the recent, you know, tour, and that earned her a number one contendership, or, you know, whatever the case may be. I mean, their house show business is doing terrible. So, you know, and the fact that it's not given any importance on their television show also, you know, feeds into that. So why not make use of that as well? There's just so many different options that could be played into here that they seemingly ignore for whatever reason. Maybe just the bottom line on everybody's checks is too good to bring it up. I have no idea.
Well, I think they're, That says something too about what somebody, the way it was at least presented in the press release and by Eric Bischoff in the podcast, a fresh set of eyes with some sense of authority and a resume to walk in and just tell people, you know, I want to hear your ideas, and I want you to not worry about what the ramifications will be. If there's something that's been on your mind that you think we can do better on the production side, the booking side, the planning side, the way we shoot interviews, the way we shoot the show, let me know. I want to hear it all, and I want to, you know, I've got my own ideas, and I want to hear yours, and you don't have to worry about ruffling feathers. It stays between us. And then I have the authority to then present my case to Vince, and we're going to do things different around here and try to improve some things. That just seems like a really, like, innocuous approach to take. No, there should be no egos hurt, and it's time just for a fresh set of eyes to improve the show. And certainly that was implied, if not promised, in the press release that got a lot of play. So why not actually do it? There's nothing to lose. And I don't see evidence of that. And I don't have hope that's going to happen, or high hopes. I can still hope, but not have a high confidence, I guess. Anyway, JJ, anything else?
Look, you know, Cody Rhodes, you know, announced that, you know, his first match, the TV show is going to be against, you know, Sammy Guevara. And, I mean, I like Sammy Guevara like that, but I really don't feel like, you know, that should have been the first match announced, because a lot of people were kind of like, too, and, you know, it kind of feels like, you know, they could have done better with that. And it's kind of like, you know, it was sort of like, you know, built it up, like, you know, they could have done Moxley, Cody, you know, they could have done all the people. And kind of also, like, Cody putting himself as, like, the first announced kind of also reeks of, you know, almost Shane McMahon type of thing. But, you know.
Thanks, JJ. A little off topic, but we'll address it here. Or maybe it's on topic because we're talking about planning matches ahead of time. And AEW, on the bright side, has planned a match 8 weeks ahead of time. Or not, you know, 8 or 9, whatever it is. Or 10. I haven't done the math. It's first week of October, so we're last week of July. So here's the thing. They shouldn't be giving away Cody against Moxley. They shouldn't be giving away Cody against a big name. They shouldn't do that on any TV show. I'm sure there'll be a big match. I shouldn't say not on any TV show. It's their first show. They want to draw a big rating up front. I don't think this is going to end up being the biggest match on the show. They're probably going to give away a big match, but I don't think every match that every top star is in should be a pay-per-view quality match out of the gate. I mean, that's not why you should tune in to watch this show, to see a pay-per-view quality lineup every week. They're going to burn everybody out if they do that. I don't think the first show should be all top 5 or 6 stars in the biggest matches they could possibly have. So I'm fine with that. That said, yes, Cody in the first match does ring some bells that people are worried about. When it comes to Cody and his ego and taking on some McMahon traits or some of his dad at his worst as a booker, and that, you know, there's not going to be as much of a step aside. I'm not the top guy. I'm a top utility guy, but I'm not going to push myself in a top way that's going to make people go, oh, here's another guy. You know, whether it's Jeff Jarrett or Eric Embry or Dusty Rhodes. I mean, you can name so many wrestlers who have been criticized for overpushing themselves. It does ring that bell a little bit. It's not proof of anything, but it gets the conversation started and makes people go, uh-oh, Cody announced himself as the first ever wrestler on the AEW TV show on TNT. I don't overreact to it, but it does sound that bell a little bit, Jake. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I guess if you're looking for alarms, it might be one. I wouldn't be overly concerned about it. I think it's a high-profile match. I think they need to have their star power present on their first episode. And, you know, they've announced the match with Cody and Sammy, and they announced, you know, Jon Moxley making an appearance. And so they're going to slowly trickle out this news over, you know, on what's going to be on their first episode. But yeah, I guess we'll have to see what the long-term trend is. I mean, there's certainly questions that are going to be asked and that will continue to be asked about how a wrestler-run company is going to work and operate, and if, you know, there's a different set of complications and political battles that will be fought versus what exists in, you know, in WWE at this point, and how, you know, how that may change and alter the show over the long term. But we'll, you know, it's a wait and see type of thing. Am I alarmed by the fact that Cody is the first announced match? Not really, but if, you know, if he's in the main event every week for 3 months, then yeah, we're obviously going to be asking those tough questions.
And also, I mean, I am for them announcing matches ahead of time. I don't think they need to announce a whole lineup for their first show. I mean, I think the types of matches they should be presenting on their first show should not be the types of matches that are going to attract a big audience, because that means you're giving away matches without using television to build them up. That first show should be an introduction to their product. There should be some good matchups. But the idea that it should be this like compelling pay-per-view lineup, that's crazy. It's the first TV show. The purpose of the TV show should be to introduce characters, forward storylines. Yes, entertain people with good promos and good athleticism, but it shouldn't be to try to produce a pay-per-view lineup. Anybody who knows who Cody's going to wrestle on that first show, anybody in the next 2 months who knows who Sammy Guevara is, they're going to be watching anyway. There's not a single person who knows what's going on with AEW and knows who's going to not watch the first show. So I'm not quite sure what the purpose of announcing it, you know, over 2 months out is. They'll trickle stuff out. I mean, of course, Moxley's going to be on the first show. Of course, Cody's going to be on the first show, and now we know he's going to wrestle. It's not that big of a deal either way. But I'm actually ultimately more relieved that it's Cody against Sammy and not Cody against Moxley or something. Like, I mean, I'm glad they're not just trying to hotshot.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we don't even know what their next pay-per-view is going to be beyond All Out. And
yeah,
so that's, you know, that's going to be what they have to establish in the first few weeks of their television show. You know, where are we going next? And they have a tall task ahead of them. You know, I don't think they have as much mainstream appeal as a lot of wrestling fans seem to assume they have. They have name value in the context of the wrestling world. I don't think they have a lot of name value outside of that sphere. And so, you know, to build up names like Cody Rhodes and the Young Bucks and Kenny Omega and John Moxley and Sammy Guevara, it's going to take some time. And then we'll have to see how long that takes and how quickly they're able to establish a rapport and try to pull in either lapsed fans or, you know, bring in new wrestling fans. It's going to be a very much a startup atmosphere. And that's exciting in some ways, and it's also scary in some ways. And I guess we'll have to see how that plays out on October 2nd.
Well, when we look at the Raw ratings this week and compared to last week, they had their Raw reunion show, and they had a lot of people tune in who normally were not tuning in to watch WWE. So it shows that you can reach people through social media and word of mouth and everything. I mean, their first hour viewership was over 3 million, and they hadn't had a first hour viewership over 3 million since the Superstar Shakeup episode months earlier. And they went from just under 2.4 million to just over 3 million. This week, they went back down to 2.4 million. They gained almost nothing from what they did. The overall rating went from a 1.74 2 weeks ago to a 2.12 this week, back down to a 1.65 rating, one of the lowest ratings they've ever drawn. They got no bump from the Raw reunion show, but there's all these lapsed fans out there who heard about Raw and tuned in to see Stone Cold and Hogan and everybody else, and then they left again. That's the lapsed fan that AEW, you know, can have as part of the mosaic of fans that they attract. It's also going to be younger, hardcore fans who will not watch Raw today and didn't watch the Raw reunion, and it's also going to be a bunch of people who watched Raw this week, last week, and the week before. It's not just one type of fan that's going to make AEW successful, but WWE sent those male 18 to 34-year-olds running again. I mean, the ratings have been awful for the 18 to 34 demo. Last week, it was double. The 18 to 34-year-old audience was double last week what it was on June 24th. So they're out there. They're willing to watch if you give them a reason to watch, even 18 to 34-year-olds who weren't around for the Monday Night War era as adults, at least, but they had a fondness as kids. A bunch of them came back, and then almost all of them left again this week. They went back to a rating lower than what they had the week before Raw reunion in that key demo. They were down in every key demo, all adults, 18 to 49-year-old adults, 18 to 49-year-old males, 18 to 34-year-old males, all the key demos that they track. So AEW the lesson here is just book a show that all types of fans, you know, like going after just lapsed fans or just the ones who watch Being the Elite within a day of it coming out. Like you have to have a vision and a formula and kind of a DNA to your presentation that is your identity. But those fans are out there to be had, and the key is just having a good product that covers a lot of the sloppy stuff that we're talking about and corrects that stuff and makes people feel like they're watching a product that respects them. Everybody's got, you know, nuggets of advice for AEW on what to do to counter-program WWE, but a number of things evident on this show and then the lesson to be learned from losing all the viewers who came back last week. Those are things I hope AEW is studying. I hope that Cody and the Bucks and Kenny are actually watching the WWE product every week, start to finish in real time, because I think that's going to help them counter program to the fans who are frustrated and not watching as consistently as they once were.
Absolutely. Yeah, they have a lot of work ahead of them, you know, and being on top of what your competition is doing is certainly a part of that research.
That's the thing. Yeah, the work involves not just being self-satisfied with how many people tell them how great and excited they are. It involves actually sitting down and watching the competition, as frustrating and boring as it might be for them, because they just want to be doing other things and getting ready for their show. Getting ready for their show is immersing themselves in what WWE is doing, and really, frankly, watching some of the old stuff too that was really good, including some stuff from the 80s and the 70s or 80s and 90s. You know, just get ideas of what used to be done well and isn't. And you know, that's Eric Bischoff's formula was successful with the early years of Nitro, and you know, he did look at WWE and decided what can we do that's going to be distinctly different, but that involved knowing what WWE was doing. Anyway, we're a little off topic or a lot off topic, take your pick, but we'll come back with our on-site correspondent after this, and then we'll answer your mailbag questions. If you haven't emailed us yet, but you're listening to the live stream, feel free, WadeKellerPodcast@pwtorch.com.
Don't just listen to PW.